Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is the second episode of Lawyers, Guns, and Money's oral history of the blogosphere. And today, I am delighted to be joined by Dan Dresner, one of the giants of the old blogosphere. And also Dan Nexon is here. He will be joining us in just a couple minutes. How are you doing first, Dan?
I guess okay. You know, I'm fully vaccinated and boosted and having a pleasant conversation with you, Rob. So, you know, there are far worse things I could be doing right now.
I mean, it seems to be sunny outside. Is that that's at least what it says, what your window seems to imply.
Yes, that's correct. It's actually like yesterday it was over 60 degrees here in Boston, which, you know, climate change has a lot of horrific effects, but I guess the occasional mild day in December I'm going to take, so we might as well take advantage of it.
Yeah, I've been coasting through Facebook memories because you can go through and see everything you've posted for the last 16 years or 14 years, something along those lines. And the number of times where I'm posting about a snowstorm over the past 2 weeks has been remarkable because the weather has been fine, right? I mean, today it's rainy, but it's also, you know, 60 degrees. So nothing really to complain about except the impending destruction of the world.
Which is a course I'm teaching next year, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I developed this last year. There's a course I'm teaching called The End of the World and What Comes After, which was sort of COVID inspired, and it's about systemic collapses. So it's been an interesting exercise, I guess.
Well, you've long been a leader in apocalypse studies, right?
That's correct. It is. I will admit this. It is the first time I've really been able to use the zombie book for what it was intended to be. So that is actually quite enjoyable.
Right. That might be. That's one worth revisiting, right? Because I don't know if we'll have a chance to talk about it today, but the inability of the international system to deal with the pandemic sort of reminds us of some of the things that were framed in the zombie book. So
there is a third edition coming out called the Apocalypse Edition that'll come out early next year.
Right. All right. So this is supposed to be an oral history of the blogosphere. And so let's start talking about blogging, right? We are, I don't know what the formal inauguration of the blogosphere is, but maybe that's one of the questions we can deal with today. But I guess to start with, just from the very beginning, when did you learn about blogging and when did you start doing a thing that would later be considered blogging?
So I think I learned about blogging actually in the late 90s. And to demonstrate how old this was, they weren't originally called blogs then. They were called me-zines, I believe. And so there were a couple of people that I was following who were sort of doing this format that I thought was particularly interesting. And so I was a consumer of blogs before I was a producer of them. And then I started blogging in, I want to say, I'm pretty sure it was September 12th, 2002. And the reason I know this is that I remember it was about a year after 9/11. And by that point, the Blogger software was available, which was ridiculously easy to use for even someone who's kludgy like me when it comes to tech. And so I kind of came to it in part because I was having difficulty placing op-eds. You know, I was someone who I was a professor of political science at the University of Chicago at the time. I obviously cared very much about publishing in scholarly outlets and so forth, but I had always also wanted to have a public voice. And so I would occasionally, you know, literally send in, you know, paper op-eds to places like the Chicago Tribune or what have you, know, the Washington Post, New York Times, and, you know, would never hear the time of day. And at that point, I think my batting average for foreign affairs submissions was obviously zero. And so the blog seemed like a good outlet by which I could occasionally write something if I wanted to and just get it out of my system. And I honestly thought when I started it that I would do it for a year and that I would sort of record what I experienced doing it and then maybe publish something in like International Studies Perspectives or something on, you know, blogging as a technique for, you know, public engagement, you know, a ethnographic report or something along those lines. And things turned out slightly differently.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting because for you, and I think at LGM, we started a little bit later, and I don't, when Dan Nexon gets here, we'll ask him the same question. But we started a little bit later, and by the time we started, there already seemed to be this question: are you going to do something useful academically, or are you going to blog? But for you in 2002, that question was not yet really there. Although, you know, I mean, and maybe you could speak to this, right? But at the University of Chicago, I'm sure that there were doubts about whether op-eds were and foreign affairs articles were a useful, something that were useful for a serious academic to do, right? But you didn't experience blogging as this conflict between real work and having fun.
I didn't. There were others who obviously did. I believe the very first sentence I wrote as a blogger was, "I shouldn't be doing this. I'm going up for tenure soon." So I knew going in, to be fair, that there were people who were going to look askance at this sort of exercise. I will also point out that you know, when I was junior, when I moved to University of Chicago, I taught at the University of Colorado at Boulder for 2 years and then moved to U of C. The same year I did that, I also got a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellowship. Now, for those listeners who aren't aware, the CFR Fellowship, it's a nice honor, and it's also a great experience because basically it means you get to work for an agency in the U.S. government or an international organization. And usually you've got a pretty good sinecure because the council pays your salary for the year, so you're free to the agency. And it struck me as something I really wanted to do, just to literally get my feet wet in terms of what actual policymaking was like, so that I thought it would make me a better professor. It never occurred to me that I would then stay permanently as a policymaker, but some did. And I was advised against doing this by my colleagues at the University of Chicago explicitly. And, you know, I didn't listen to them then. I deferred it for a year, and I spent a year at the U of C, and then I went to the Treasury Department and very much enjoyed that experience. And I've no complaints about that. But it should also indicate that I wasn't necessarily listening to the counsel of my senior colleagues about what I should be doing in terms of public engagement and or other aspects of it, because I frankly thought they were wrong. I didn't see that there was a trade-off between serious scholarship and public engagement. I didn't think there was a serious trade-off in terms of blogging and publishing in the AJPS or IO.
So Dan Nexon has now joined us. How are you doing, Dan?
Doing fine. I wish I'd been here at the beginning, but I will get up to speed.
Well, the only question that we've gone through at this point is, when did you start? So, and I think we've mostly made it through the first year. So,
but Dan, it sounded like Dan was talking about pushback or whether he had any concerns from his colleagues. Is that right?
So, I would say that, I mean, first of all, in terms of concerns from colleagues about blogging, there were no concerns when I started because they had no idea what blogging was. For them to be concerned, they'd have to be aware of what we were talking about. And, you know, blogs were starting to emerge. And I really did. I was extremely fortunate in terms of when I started because, you can argue it was sort of is the word fluorescence or efflorescence, I think. I can't remember. Jack Goldstone had a term for it, but basically like this sort of Cambrian explosion of blogs. And I was like there at right around the time that they really started to explode. So I don't think my colleagues were even aware that I was doing this for at least a couple of months. And then if they did become aware, it created an awkward problem for them because to indicate that they were aware of it to me would also have to indicate that they'd read it. And, you know, that was that would imply that they were surfing the web or, you know, not reading journal articles or things like that. And, you know, it's like admitting you watch television or something. It was somehow, you know, and I would actually, it was very funny in those years. Occasionally I would have a colleague who would say, you know, or something along the lines of, you know, I read this that you wrote. And then they would have to almost automatically say like, but like I stumbled on it. Like it was like I accidentally typed the URL on my computer or something. It was somehow like they couldn't admit that they had actually tried to read what I had written. And that frankly was true, I would say, for the first couple of years I was doing it. And not just at the UOC, but in a lot of places. There was a demographic split that people who were our age or younger, grad students or what have you, they were perfectly enthusiastic about the fact that I was doing this. But like any senior or tenured person, where it came up in conversation, they would then make a face like they had sucked a lemon or something. Like, you know, it wasn't they had like made some terrifying admission that they'd actually read the blog.
That reminds me of a Simpsons quote, right? I only came in here to ask for directions to get away from here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Who was it? Do you guys remember? I'm sure you remember, but it goes to exactly this generational divide you're talking about. But there was an op-ed put out by some senior faculty member somewhere, but I believe it was put out anonymously. And I can't remember if it was in the Chronicle or somewhere else.
It was the Chronicle.
Was it the Chronicle? Yeah. Saying that any blogging would cause irremediable damage to your career, because even if you stopped blogging, you might still be thinking about blogging, right? And you might blog at some point in the future, and you could never prove to the committee that you would never blog again, which I think came in for a lot of fun at the time and even later. So
yeah, I do remember. I want to say that the fake name, the pseudonym was Leo something. I won't swear to that, but I remember it came out in like 2005 or something. But yes, I have distinct memories of that. And you know, just thought it was somewhat risible, but you know, it wasn't entirely wrong at the time that it was written, probably.
So apart from just your colleagues and other graduate students and so forth, when did you start noticing, and how did you start noticing that people were paying attention to what you were writing? How did you start growing an audience, and that audience start having an impact on your life?
I mean, there were a couple things that happened. The first was, and maybe this was luck or something, it was literally within the first 24 hours of having the blog, I think I wrote something about remembering what it was like the year before. As I said, I started around 9/11 and talking about what it was like on the actual day of 9/11. And on the actual September 11, 2001, I was stranded in London because I was supposed to be flying back from a European conference, and you know, all the planes got grounded, and I just wrote a paragraph about how I was touched that, you know, a lot of Londoners, you know, once they heard my American accent, were extremely nice to me and decent to me, you know, just sort of expressing their sympathies and so forth. Glenn Reynolds, who goes by the name of Instapundit, linked to it. And so that generated a lot of traffic, as you can imagine. And I think that might've put me on some people's radar, you know, at sort of the get-go. And then I think there were a few other things that did it. The first was that obviously the debate about the Iraq war was starting. And I blogged a fair amount about that. And at the time I would say I wasn't opposed to the idea of invading Iraq, which put me in the minority in terms of the international relations community, but not necessarily the minority in terms of the blogosphere. But, you know, I also referenced arguments that were being put out there by, including my colleague, John Mearsheimer, saying that this was a bad idea. And I thought that an airing of those debates was appropriate. And so, you know, that happened. And then I think the other thing that might have gotten me on the radar was that Andrew Sullivan began to notice me. And if memory serves, I think it was that first, Christmas break. Sullivan was going on a hiatus and he wanted someone to guest blog for him. And he asked me. And so I said yes, because, you know, it was certainly an interesting experience. And then I got to see what Sullivan's world is like, because he gave me access to his email and so forth. And that was just a fascinating window into the ways in which, if you're a truly big time blogger, the world can mess with you. Because, you know, the number of people who would email Sullivan at that point, who would say along the lines of, I hate you, and yet I'm obsessed with you, and I can't stop thinking about you. It was a lot of bizarre shit that he got in his email. And that has to have an effect on someone. And it was a fascinating sort of window into the world that he had to be experiencing at the time. And then the final thing that I think that happened that I think also sort of promoted me was that the New Republic was developing an online section. And they contacted both me and my colleague, Jacob Levy, who started a blog about a month or two later, and asked us to be sort of monthly columnists for them. And, you know, we were both, I was probably a little more, but we were both enthusiastic about it, mostly because at that point, the idea that a mainstream media outlet would ask you to do, would ask us, you know, as lowly academics to do this was fascinating, and also legitimate. You know, that this was the idea that we had somehow sort of made the big time, as it were. And so that was, I think, another thing that sort of attracted eyeballs.
So it's interesting that you mentioned September 11th, the Iraq War, because there is a whole line of thought that says that the one of these moments or both of these moments really was the thing that drove, or were the things that drove, the blogosphere, political blogosphere at least, into prominence, importance, significance. What is your take on that kind of argument?
I mean, I think there's some truth to it. I think there's a confluence of events. As I said, and I think Matt Iglesias said this in his podcast recording with you, part of it was just the blogger software. The fact that anyone could then create a blog, no matter how HTML illiterate they were, was not an insignificant thing, because it obviously meant that suddenly you didn't need the sort of web designing skills that, let's say, someone like, you know, Andrew Sullivan had on his site, or Josh Marshall had on TPM, or Virginia Postrel had on something called The Dynamist, which she used to be running. So that was one thing. And so I think in some ways it was a combination of demand and supply, as it were, that 9/11 and, you know, the decision to invade Iraq obviously created a lot of interest in sort of political commentary. But the other thing was that suddenly it was easier for people to be able to supply those opinions around what we would consider traditional gatekeepers. You know, I remember when I was a postdoc at Harvard, we had I don't want to name the person because I'm not sure this would be entirely fair. We had a very senior person come in, you know, within the sort of foreign policy media sphere, who at one point just sort of said, look, if you want to impact or have an influence on policy discussions, there's five places you can publish. There's Foreign Affairs, there's the New York Times, there's the Washington Post, there's the Wall Street Journal, and at the time, the Washington Times, because it was a conservative outlet. And that sort of stuck with me. I remembered that, thinking that. And what blogs were starting to do was essentially break that down. Because suddenly it turned out that people who were at least far more prominent than us in the sort of public sphere were actually reading these things. And then you could potentially, you know, make a comment that would sort of trickle upwards, as it were. And so, yeah, I think that partially it was demand and it was also supply. And I guess I would close with, and I'm not normally a fan of his work, but I really do. Malcolm Gladwell had an interesting chapter, I think, in Outliers, about the sort of rise of a particular group of New York lawyers and intellectual property, I want to say, and how it was basically this group that all came along at exactly the right moment, where suddenly there was the demand for their services right after the end of World War II. And I've always thought that sort of explains what happened to the blogosphere beginning in late 2002.
So you were part, and Lawyers Guns Money comes 2 years later. We came in at the very tail end of a period in which there could still be said to be a blogosphere. A single blogosphere where people who from the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere still mm-hmm. spoke to one another, still cited one another, linked to one another. Mm-hmm. But how as an early adopter did you adapt to what was really became the polarization of these two hemispheres of the blogosphere into like completely non-communicative by like 2005? That may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but I don't think it's that much of one.
No, I mean, I think I was someone who, I mean, I started, you know, I was at the time I started blogging a Republican. I was a registered Republican. I had worked on George W. Bush's 2000 campaign as a very informal campaign advisor, because Condi Rice had been one of my professors at Stanford. I had supported the Iraq War, but I then quickly soured on it, obviously. But I would say that the way I coped with this, I guess, suppose the answer was not well, in the sense that one of the things I liked about the blogosphere was the idea that, you know, I could quote Glenn Reynolds one time and then quote Duncan Black from Atreos, you know, the next time, or literally, you know, talk about the sort of range of opinion and the fact that they were talking to each other. So as they began to sort of cocoon, I guess would be the way to put it, you know, I it I think I had a negative reaction to that, because it wasn't why I was trying to blog in the first place. What I thought was interesting was, hey, there's this idea out there. Let's think about it. Let's weigh it. Let's assess it. Let's consider the pros and cons and so forth. And, you know, maybe there was a time where I had a definitive opinion about something, but it wasn't always. And, you know, I really did believe in, I guess, taking in, you know, heterogeneous points of view on this. And so also the other thing was that the reality on the ground was changing. So it was becoming increasingly clear that Iraq was not going to end, you know, with a quick victory, as it were, that the post-war planning had been done extremely poorly. And that in my case, you know, people that I had trusted as competent were clearly not so. And so part of this for me was an alienation from, I think, things that I had accepted as given in 2002, that by 2004, I'm winding up saying, yeah, I'm going to vote for John Kerry. You know, and so it was, in some ways, it was a fascinating experience watching people. And I think the other thing I would say is that different bloggers reacted in different ways to this. There were some who would sort of double down on whatever their original proposition was and go even further in that direction. And then there were some who were like, well, wait a minute, this is, you know, I'm looking at what's happening in Fallujah, and that's clearly not, you know, what we were being told in terms of how the war was going to go and so forth. And so, you know, it was an interesting experience to deal with this. But I would say that, you know, really, I think I was on still pretty good terms. And I mean, I was part of that, like, I think it was called Pajamas Media. Like, there was that, you know, collective in, I want to say 2006 or 2007, I was part of that for a couple of years. So I was still somewhat comfortable talking to, you know, folks like Glenn Reynolds or Roger Simon or what have you. And it really wasn't, I think, until Obama got elected that I began to notice that there was an even further, you know, drift rightward by some of these folks.
Yeah, that's interesting, because obviously the Duck of Minerva came in 2006. So we are after your generation, but before blogging became, how do I want to put it? We were certainly before peak political science blogging. That is when political scientists got into the blogosphere when it was already dead, so to speak. But my impression was very much that
there's no trend that we can't get into 5 years after it's done.
Oh yeah, yeah. So we'll, you know, in 10 years we'll be on TikTok. But my impression was that the foreign policy discussion remained cross-partisan for longer than the domestic politics discussion. And it really was in part 2008 that broke it.
I think that's probably a safe statement. You know, it might have been the surge also. That could have been something, because, you know, and this is what, you know, I don't know if I can date it exactly. Like, and partially this is due to my own faltering memory at this point, because, you know, I don't want to say that I have a perfect memory of what everyone's position was at the time and how it's evolved. But I would say that what began to happen, like when the duck started, and then was the monkey cage like around the same time, correct?
A little after.
What you began seeing was that thankfully other political scientists began, you know, and then there had always been Crooked Timber. You know, you began seeing other academics sort of trying to weigh in. And I would also say that in some ways, what a lot of these academics were doing was something different from what I had been doing, which was, you know, there were times, and there are still times, where if I'm blogging or writing a column, I'm writing a column based on my own expertise in a subject matter because I've researched it deeply. And then there are other times where I was writing based on, hey, I'm a consumer of this literature, and I think I can distill essentially what this literature is saying. But then there were other posts where I was, you know, saying what I thought and, you know, not necessarily saying it is, you know, I have spoken, therefore it is thus, because I knew that the rest of the political science, you know, community might have other opinions, or because there was a, you know, someone who had more expertise writing about it. But I think the sort of thing where you had political scientists writing primarily about their areas of expertise and then blogging about them and then critiquing what others were saying in the sort of marketplace of ideas, I mean, I contributed to that, but I think there were others who did it better than I did.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I think we all have opinions about whether the monkey cage was an inflection point and what effects that had on academic blogging. But I want to back up a few steps because I would like you to talk. So one of the things that your comment just, I think, made very clear is that when we talk about the politics blogosphere of, you know, about the time that you all were starting out through maybe 2008, let's take that as the arc. There is not a clear distinction between what we think of as academic blogging and politics blogging. Mm-hmm. And blogs tended to be very, had that sort of informality where, you know, you might be talking about television shows, one right. post, and then talking about some deep area of expertise on sanctions or, mm-hmm. you know, why you should abolish the Air Force or whatever in the next post. And part of what we're talking about, right, is what happened to that relationship between politics blogging and academic blogging. Yeah. But I'd like to go back because I think it would be really useful for people who have no idea of this history to hear a little bit about Pajamas Media and what it was like to be involved in that and what that was all about.
So, you know, you have to remember that when you talk about the blogosphere, and what everyone forgets is that the people would use two phrases. There was the blogosphere and then there was the mediasphere. With the idea that blogs were somehow this more authentic form of, you know, discourse because it didn't rely on, you know, op-ed page editors or what have you. I have to say, I think even at the time, and indeed the paper that I co-authored with Henry Farrell about this pointed out that this was always a rather bizarre way of thinking about it because the sort of most prominent bloggers between 2001 and 2003, if you looked at their academic bona fides, a lot of them were professors, and most of them had graduate degrees of one form or another. So the idea that this was somehow salt of the earth, common men, you know, finally giving voice, was never entirely accurate. And indeed, I think the bloggers that wound up, you know, rising to prominence were those that were seen as decent enough writers, but also had the other credentials such that, you know, the New York Times would say, hey, do you want to write an op-ed for us? Or the Washington Post would do the same thing. And so that was never the case. That said, I think another strain of this, particularly on the right wing side of it, was this belief that the entire mainstream media was, you know, pretty far on the left, and that blogs represented this appropriate and important counterweight to this that would provide, you know, an alternative point of view beyond Fox News and talk radio, as it were. And so I think there was a book, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was called South Park Conservatives, I want to say, that talked about this as well, sort of celebrating the idea that there were conservative blogs. So anyway, I want to say it was Glenn Reynolds, but I won't swear to this, sort of decided, okay, well, why don't we, you know, the problem with blogs at the time was, could people get paid for this? You know, because that's the other thing. When people started blogging, we weren't getting paid anything. There was no money involved. I mean, there were tip jars, if memory serves. You could install a tip jar, which I didn't do, but, like, you know, the idea was that way some people could
well, there's no fintech for it, right? I mean, the tip jars, I know, often just didn't even work, right?
And right. Yeah, yeah,
you tried to put, there was no, how much of the money is actually going to find its way there?
Also, the norms of paying small amounts over the internet at that point were it didn't exist. And so I think that was something else. And so this is why whenever I say that Substack is essentially a return to blogging, I'm very amused by the reactions that generates because it's a return to blogging. But it's a return to blogging that is economically viable potentially for the few that can actually pull that off. And so the idea behind Pajamas Media was, well, okay, the only way we're going to be able to make money is if we form this collective group that, you know, does banner ads or, you know, it basically makes money through online advertising. And they reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to do this? And, you know, I wasn't making any money blogging at that point. I think I started off at Blogger and then I created my own website a year or two later and like paid a web designer to actually make it look pretty and had the software to be able to do that. But basically they came to me and said, hey, we'll pay you X amount of money if you will join this collective to at least start off with. And I'm like, well, X amount of money is better than no amount of money. So I will say yes to that. And so I did that for, I think, 2 years, I want to say. I'm honestly not sure. And this is all before Foreign Policy came calling, which was in the fall of 2008. And that was a major inflection point in terms of, at least I think, the way political scientists thought about blogs. We can get to that in a little bit. But yeah, I think their idea was, it was almost all conservatives. There might have been one or two people who were also left of center that were part of that. But it was mostly a conservative group of bloggers, with the idea that if they organized collectively, they might actually be able to get some money in terms of ad revenue.
How'd that go?
Honestly, I don't remember. I mean, this was literally, they offered to pay me a certain amount per year. I will be honest, I didn't think it was going to be viable. But again, as I said, I was not going to say no to the money, because, you know, I had two small children and wanted to provide for them. So it wasn't a huge amount either, but it seemed better than doing what I was otherwise going to do, which was blog for free. So I don't think it worked terrifically well, but I also don't think it failed miserably. In fact, as far as I'm aware, it might still exist. And so, you know, it also became clear, I think, over time that I was growing more ideologically out of step with what we would consider the sort of median blogger within Pajamas Media, which, again, I didn't terribly mind, because they were the ones that asked me in the first place. So it wasn't like others asked me to join their collectives or what have you. So I was perfectly fine with that. And then also, obviously, the tenor of the discourse started to change as well. And yeah, in some ways, 2008 really was an inflection year for a variety of reasons.
So I want to come back to the inflection points a little bit, but I wanted to go to a technical question first. And I asked Matt the same question. I mean, you've had, like anybody who's been around, you've had a lot of different sites over this time, and you've blogged in a lot of different places. How much of your archive do you still have access to? Do you still have control over? Are there still Dresner Blogspot? Is there still a Dresner Blogspot website out there that you could post on?
There is a Dresner Blogspot website, but someone took it over at some point, because I simply stopped logging in after a while. And I remember, this was probably about 10 years ago, I like checked it out, and like some guy dressed in a clown face or something had taken it over. So I won't swear to it if he's still there, but like at the time he had taken it over. And I was like, well, that's on me. I hadn't, you know, tended to it. I still do have, I believe, my own website, in which in theory you should be able to access my blog entries there. The other thing is that when I agreed to move to Foreign Policy, they actually paid me a lump sum to import all of the blog posts I had ever written to their website. So I believe in theory, like anything that I wrote from 2002 to 2014, in theory, is at Foreign Policy site. I honestly have no idea. It's not something I'm terrifically concerned with, but yeah, in theory, it's all there. But that said, I remember, like, even back in the mid 2000s, there was this term called link rot.
Mm-hmm, right.
And you know, it's clearly a thing.
Right. Right. No, I've gone back and dug into for LGM, we changed from being a blogspot to a WordPress, and everything is link rotted before a certain period of time for us.
Yeah, exactly.
When I came back to rebuild the Duck of Minerva this year, there was still a blog roll. And going through that blog roll, I will say that there were very few links that hadn't rotted into oblivion.
I hope you kept the blog roll, because, like, I mean, you know, there are bloggers whose, like, names, like, you know, are still burned into my memory that have, like, not written anything, or, like, passed, in some cases died, but in other cases retired, that, like, I still occasionally think about. Stephen Den Best, I think, was his name. You remember him? You know, like, I mean, he was the Glenn Greenwald of his time in some ways, and that, like, you know, he could never write something in 50 words that wouldn't take 5,000.
Kim Dutoit.
Oh God.
No. I mentioned in the Iglesias pod too, that some absurd percentage of LGM readers still come from the link on Atreus or on Eschaton, right?
That's
that they're
amazing.
Just clicking the link on the blog roll in Eschaton to get to LGM.
Wow.
And it's like almost as many as come from Facebook, come from just that link. So, since you brought it up, I wanted to ask a little bit, and you actually brought it up twice, right? First, you brought it up in the context of Sullivan and going through the reactions that he was getting, and the really hyperbolic reactions. Although he's a guy that one can hyperbolize about,
right? I mean, that's sort of the nature of his writing in some ways, right. Which I think has its strengths and weaknesses, obviously.
But you also just mentioned Glenn. And, you know, one of the questions I have is about how, and I think all three of us have experienced this, right? Undergoing just really the traumatic experience of just suddenly having thousands of people furious at you for some reason, right? often because of something we said, but often also just because somebody of prominence got angry at us and decided to send a horde of flying monkeys. And actually, either of you can answer that question. I'm just really curious, like, how, because as academics, we're prepared for a certain kind of psychological trauma, but it's usually reviewer two or the asshole discussant at the conference or the professor in our class who's destroying our work. It's not being subjected suddenly to the raving lunatics of the general public. So how did you guys adjust to that kind of sort of threat profile?
Speaking for myself, I would actually argue that this is where being an academic, I think, was the best preparation for being a blogger. Because, as you say, you know, part of our job is to take not fully formed ideas, but very often draft papers. And let's be honest, draft papers that we probably should have spent more work on before we presented them, to present them to people who are really, really smart, and get an intellectual incentive from finding all of the logical flaws in your argument. And so, you know, to me, that sort of intellectual engagement is easily the most terrifying thing. You know, I mean, I can't speak for you guys, but there are days where, like, you know, I'm going to be presenting somewhere and there's a part of me that thinks this is the day they find out I'm a fraud. This is the day that they find out just the total crap that I've produced. And, you know, just, I am not worthy of my PhD and all of that. That part is just really hard. And, like, you know, we all have memories of not the person who is overly nasty, but rather the person who has actually found the real flaw in your argument that you hadn't thought about, that you now realize you are going to have to deal with for months or years before you are going to feel confident enough to present this again. And, you know, it didn't happen that often, but it would occasionally happen. And so that's the stuff that I find scarring. Compared to that, someone emailing me or tweeting at me or responding in a blog comment, Dresner, you're an asshole, you know, just doesn't do it for me. Like, I don't care about that. I find it, there are times where I always want to respond, well, you're just making an assertion. You have no evidence for this. You know, that's, where's your data on this?
You don't even know me.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm an asshole, but.
Yeah. You know, and so, honestly, most of that stuff I don't find terribly, I probably have the advantage of, you know, the comfort of being a middle-aged white guy. So, you know, I probably get less of it, I'm assuming, than women or people of color. And also I'm pretty mainstream, at least I'm not out there advocating for state ownership of banks and or, you know, Islamo, or, you know, railing about Islamo fascism, I guess. And so, by and large, the only times I've really sort of felt it, I would say, were first in 2016 when I was getting a shit ton of anti-Semitic comments my way, at least on Twitter. And someone in the blog comments. The other thing that happened is, at least for me, is that as I began to write for Foreign Policy and then eventually the Washington Post, it got to the level where I just stopped reading comments. Literally, it's the don't read the comments thing, but I actually practiced that because it was clear that they weren't adding any value. And I felt really sad about this because when I started blogging, I really liked the comments. I had a small, you know, interesting following that were legitimately, like, they would have arguments within the comments. And the arguments were good arguments. They weren't, like, nasty, like, you know, just name-calling arguments. And there got to be a point where I just stopped reading them, which saved me a lot of mental energy. And then the other, I suppose, so the 2016 was a problem. And then occasionally, you know, usually about once every 6 months, I tweet something where I didn't mean what I did nonetheless tweet. And so then I have to deal with, you know, the social media firestorm, which is not fun. And I don't recommend anyone have to deal with it. But, you know, it is what it is.
I do want to take a second to just acknowledge something that I'm not sure people who are coming at this from a political science background would really understand, which is that when we talk about the blogosphere, we're really talking about the political blogosphere. Mm-hmm. That most of what was going on in blogging in this period was like most of what's going on in Instagram and most of what's going on in Twitter. It was fashion blogging. It was mommy blogging.
Movie.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is really a kind of, and I think that also helps to, helps people understand how that first wave of blogging could be such a small social circle, right? There, you know, in the sense that, you know, you could have get-togethers where pretty much everybody showed up. This was not such a huge community, even as it grew, in the mid 2000s compared to most of what was out there.
And there was also networks. I mean, I want to stress there were some people, like I'd never met Glenn Reynolds in person. I never met Duncan Black in person. Although if I did, he'd probably try to hit me or something. But, you know, there were people though that I got to know as a result of this. And indeed there were people that I wound up, you know, co-authoring with because of this. I mean, Henry Farrell among others, was really great. I do remember there was a blog panel that I organized. This was another, not an inflection point, but it was a fascinating moment. And it was in 2004, I think, for APSA in Chicago. And the panelists were, I got Anna Marie Cox, who at that point was writing Wonkette, to come. Andrew Sullivan had said yes, although he wound up not showing up, which was not terrifically surprising. It was Henry Farrell, myself, and then Laura McKenna and Antoinette Pohl, I think. And we filled a ballroom at the Palmer House, which was stunning to me. You know, it was just a bizarre moment where, like, clearly, at least political scientists were legit interested in this at that point. That was a fascinating, you know, little vignette, I guess.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that I was there because that would have been what?
September, it would have been September of 2004, so, right, exactly.
Yeah, we would have been blogging for three months or so at that point. So so we've used the phrase inflection points a lot, and this is one of the things I'm really curious about with respect to this project. So there are two related questions here. One is, what are the major inflection points? And the ones we've talked about so far are the Iraq War, right? So we can say March of 2003, the election of Obama. But I think there might be more. And the second, and this related question is, when is the final inflection point, right? When is it that the blogosphere, the political blogosphere, essentially ceases to be a thing despite the fact that people are still blogging? So another way of phrasing that is, when did the blogosphere die and why did it die? And how is that related to these earlier inflection points we have in the life of the blogosphere?
That's really interesting. I think there were two things that killed the blogosphere as we know it. The first and the most obvious one was Twitter. You know, prior to Twitter, I can't remember who coined this term, but, you know, we used to talk about bloggers as being either linkers or thinkers, right? That there were, you know, like, so Glenn Reynolds at Instapundit, for example, he was a linker. Like, you know, his blog posts were a sentence sometimes, at which contained a link. I mean, in some ways it was Twitter before Twitter. And then there were comments in response to it, but, like, you know, it was just the quick one sentence, blog post. And then there were thinkers, like Brad DeLong would write a, you know, 3,000 word thing, you know, involving, you know, Paul O'Neill and the origins of the Iraq War and what have you. During the blog, I would say it was still, as you're defining the political blogosphere, I think the political blogosphere lasted as long as we would actually write blog posts and or comments on other people's blogs. And that was where the center of gravity of the discourse was. So, like, I remember there were times where, you know, I would write something and then Brad DeLong would push back on me at something. And then I would write back and, you know, this is going to sound weird. I actually kind of miss those debates. Like, I really loved debating the hell out of Brad. It was a good conversation. I think we respected each other. We still do, obviously, but, like, it was a legitimate intellectual engagement. I actually really enjoyed that. And you know, and he pushed me, and I like to think that I pushed him in terms of the ways we were thinking about things. And there were other engagements I had, like even when I moved to foreign policy, I remember at one point, like engaging Glenn Greenwald on his definition of the foreign policy community. And he actually like responded to me and didn't respond to me with like 10,000 words, but like, actually, I actually felt like we were making progress in that conversation, which was interesting to me. But then what happened was, is that a lot of the comments and sort of reaction to people's blog posts and so on and so forth migrated to Twitter. And that's a harder, Twitter has a lot of advantages to it. But sustaining a conversation is extremely difficult. Especially because of the quote tweet phenomenon, where if you're actually trying to follow a discourse on Twitter, it's next to impossible. And so that's thing one. Thing two, which I think was somewhat related, is, and I think the phrase that, that people talked about was taking the Boeing, which is that a lot of bloggers, you know, got hired by mainstream media outlets, myself included. You know, so The Atlantic hired a bunch of them, Slate hired a bunch of them. In my case, Foreign Policy came calling in the fall of 2008. And it's not that this changed necessarily what we did immediately. It didn't, I don't think, but it did start to slowly alter how we wrote also, because part of the appeal of blogging, I think, for me was the idea that it was an intellectual sketch pad. So you could write a paragraph or two and that would be that. And I did that for Foreign Policy for a long time as well. And then what became clear was they wanted more column-like structures. And when I moved to the Washington Post, that was, you know, it was also, eventually it became clear that that was the appropriate way to write for that. And the problem is, once you start doing that, it's tougher to have the sort of quick hit back and forth engagement. And so I think this was true of everyone. It didn't start off that way. I think when people were originally migrated to these locales, they kept the blogging structure in terms of like maybe writing two paragraphs. But over time, I think everyone started writing more like columnists, I guess would be the way to put it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I experienced that exactly. My first institutional experience was at the American right. Prospect. And even while I was at the Prospect, we were definitely migrating in a direction of posts that were more standalone, that were less conversational, yeah. quick hits with somebody else. And then every job I've had after that has all been standalone column, because editors want right. standalone columns, in part because it's easier to sell standalone columns on social right. media. Right, on
and
Facebook
and
on
by
Twitter.
The way, there were institutional blogs that I actually think, you know, tried to maintain this for a little while, but I think eventually it was sort of a cascade effect. So like, you know, NRO's The Corner, for example, I think was an example of a genuine blog structure that stayed around for a while, but then eventually, you know, you just wouldn't bother looking at it. And so essentially what happened was, is that instead of, you know, looking at or searching individual blogs, you began looking at Twitter.
I mean, I think that the shift to monologuing, right, from dialogue in the blog sphere, I think you're right that Twitter is probably the major culprit there. But we also all noticed before Twitter really took off that people stopped clicking on links. And once people aren't following links yeah. anymore, you can have that dialogue, but people can't follow it. And I have to think that that has right. something to do with it, particularly if that stops, you know, it ceases to be a source of traffic. You know, except for the big blog aggregators who hang around, who have you know, first mover advantage, mm-hmm. Network effects, et cetera. So I have to think that that has something to do mm-hmm. with it. And I have to think that that's tied to these processes of professionalization that you talk about. And what's interesting to me yeah. is that, you know, when political science sort of invades this sphere as a thing, right, rather than an individual political scientist, mm-hmm. I think it probably contributes to that professionalization. But I don't know if that's right, whether you yeah. think that's true.
Well, I think the other thing that happened was, is that a lot of the political science blogs then eventually wound up partnering with mainstream media outlets. I mean, we know the Monkey Cage migrated to the Washington Post. Was it Mischiefs of Faction, I think, that started, you know, working with Vox? You know, even more, there were, the idea was that you started seeing mainstream media outlets trying to buy blogs, you know, wholesale. I mean, and the Post did this. I think it was the Veloc conspiracy that started off with them, and then now they're at Reason. But there were very few academic bloggers or academic blogs of any prominence that didn't wind up getting that kind of offer at some point, I think. And then, of course, when you do that, And there are valid reasons to do it, which is, among other things, you're going to get paid, which is not a bad thing. But it does mean that you know, you're now working for someone. And so as a result, there is a, you know, there is an editorial consideration. So, for example, when I agreed to go to the Post, you know, one of the things I dug in on, and which they gave me, was first that if I wanted to just publish something, I could click publish and it would go live. And also I got choice of headline. The headlines were mine. And that was something I was adamant about, because I had seen enough people get screwed over because they had written a column and then the headline was totally at variance with what they were saying, and they wound up having to defend the headline. Now, that said, have I ever actually clicked publish on something that I wrote? No, because I value copy editors. I value, you know, I've over time, I've learned the value of having, you know, the editors look at it and catch something if I screwed up. And I would say it worked both ways also, because they were originally, for example, the Post was extremely uncomfortable initially with the fact that I had this much autonomy, and my editors were worried about this. And there was like a 3-month shakeout period where we sort of learned to trust each other, I think would be the way to put it. But that is a professionalization as well. I think you're right.
Why and when did people stop clicking the links? Because it seems to be a universal phenomenon, or at least in my corner of the political blogosphere. And I don't know if I've ever heard a convincing explanation of why, because it does seem to have preceded the existence of Twitter.
I have a few thoughts, but I think the most obvious one is that maybe people started reading us on their phones.
I think that's also why commenting starts to die. It's much harder to enter comments in a comment box on WordPress or whatever on a phone than it,
or a tablet. Than or it is, yeah.
And if you think about Twitter, you have a dedicated structure for, you know, it's designed to allow you to write on it, and WordPress mobile is not. Now, there are some things like, you know, Facebook comments that are a little bit easier to deal with, and you see that those are still fairly ubiquitous on sites that have them. So that's just my theory. But I want to hear you expand on this, because I do think cell phones have a lot to do with it.
No, I think, I think there's a couple of things. I think mostly it's cell phones, to be honest. I think it depends on what is the device that we're being read on. And I think the fact is an increasing fraction of readers, period, are reading things on phones rather than even just laptops or desktops. And so that's part of it. So, like, you know, it's funny when you say people don't click on the links anymore. I click on links because I don't read as much nearly from my phone as I do from my laptop. So I do click on links. It's also possible that people don't link as much as they used to. And this goes to, I mean, the one thing we haven't talked about, which is an elephant in the room, but should be mentioned, is, you know, we talk in political science about the growing polarization of American politics. I think this affected blogs just as much, in that you had, you know, people who could talk to each other in 2002 and 2003 literally despise each other, maybe by late 2003, but honestly, like by 2009, you know, you're starting to see people, or 2007, you know, starting to say things like, I guess the way to put it is that people that you previously would have thought of as, okay, I can engage this person, then you began to think of, wait, you're saying what about Trig Palin, or you're saying what about Barack Obama? Like, you know, just stuff where it was like, what's the point of engaging in this? There was no point.
I mean, on the foreign policy side, I think about this in terms of, from a left perspective, increasingly finding the conservatives that I read or that I engaged with, either linking to, talking about, or promulgating themselves, Islamophobic sentiments. And then, you know, so very sort of some of the stuff that we saw, we saw a lot of this rah-rah stuff that was very controversial around the time that you're talking about, you know, Saul that's talking about fifth columnists, the Iraq war, you know, is very, you know, the run-up to the Iraq war is extremely contentious, but there's still dialogue, right? And there's something about, and then as things get underway, I think there's still some discussion of that. But yeah, there's something about the tenor of things. And you had more context in this category, but it always, what I sort of understood was that the reward structure in the conservative blog sphere was very oriented towards it was very oriented towards escalating rhetoric. And I'm not sure.
I mean, it was, you know, it's what we would call outbidding. Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's, yeah. I mean,
yeah. So, I mean,
the same was true on the left. I mean, it's just that the political science blogs, even most of them on the left, didn't occupy the far left. You know, we weren't sort of playing the same game as Daily Kos or whatever. Right.
So. Well, also we're political scientists. So, I mean, this is where different professional norms kick in, which is even if you believe in, you know, I don't mean this in a, like, even if you believe in, you know, we need a Marxist utopia or what have you, you're going to write about it in such a way that usually, you know, even someone who is a Hayekian can read it and understand and, you know, it's going to be free of pejoratives. And so in the political blogosphere, yeah, you're right. That what began to happen, I think, particularly on the right, is that there was clearly this subculture that did think Barack Obama was illegitimately elected and didn't think that he was a U.S. citizen, or thought that it was the start of socialism in America. And I will say, I hadn't read it at the time, but having read Atlas Shrugged since then, I can kind of see why they think that. They're wrong, but like I can see why they think that, because there is a sort of parallel within that book that I think inspires a lot of sort of Randians to believe that they've, you know, sort of latched onto some central truth. And this is why you have folks like Paul Ryan, who are now looked at as reasonable conservatives, talking in 2008 like this is the beginning of socialism in America and what have you. And for me, I think the line for me was at least on the political economy side, was the sudden conviction circa 2010 that we were going to turn into Greece, which was just horseshit. There's no other way to get around this. It was just flat out insane logic. And that was the moment where I was like, I don't understand what the hell is happening on that side of the political blogosphere. And I think it was the final break for me. You know, I stayed a Republican nominally. I was a Rhino, literally, until 2016. When Trump got elected, that was the next week I went to the office or my local office and re-registered as an independent. But I was essentially a Rhino from, I would say, probably 2006 to 2016.
So, you know, writ large, when you think about what blogging has meant to your career, how blogging has affected your career,
yeah.
Right? It's had a lot of impacts on your career. It's been a big deal for you. But you know, how would you sum up what blogging has meant to you and what blogging meant for the person you are now?
I think the way I would put it is that, and I wrote about this for the Chronicle of Higher Ed about a decade ago. There is no denying that blogging had certain problems for me. I mean, I will never be able to say for sure. I was, you know, for listeners who aren't ancient, I was denied tenure at the University of Chicago in late 2005. Anyone who's been denied tenure somewhere will tell you that, you know, you're never entirely going to know what happened. The nature of the process is such that you can't entirely know what happens. Do I think that my blogging had something to do with it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it did. You know, it was the belief by many there that because I had somehow, by colleagues who weren't necessarily engaged in public engagement, that assumed that all words take equal amount of effort to write, which is not even remotely true. That the amount of effort it takes to write a blog post is less than it takes to write a foreign affairs essay, which is much less than it takes to write an APSR article. Nonetheless, you know, if I could go back and change things, there's no way I would. The advantages of blogging for me is that it's given me a public voice, which I have valued. There are times where I've written things where I know, you know, I've at least, I think, had an impact on a debate. Or influence the way some people have thought. But most important, I think, is that I never thought of the blog as conclusive writing. I always thought of it, I mean, I talked about this in the Ideas Industry book. I always thought of it as a form of contingent writing. And I would like to think that even in the days when I was supporting the invasion of Iraq, I was writing things, hopefully, that said, look, I'm not entirely sure about this, but this is why I think this is the case. And trying to demonstrate, you know, sort of uncertainty, I would hope, in terms of the way I phrase things. And there were ideas that I originally wrote as a blog post that wound up becoming, started off as a blog post that wound up becoming much more fully thought out ideas in journal articles or books for that matter. So the zombie book started as a one-off blog post that I realized, you know, something was there and I couldn't figure out quite how to do it. And then it became, you know, the book. And there have been multiple articles that I've published that started off as blog posts, you know, journal articles. And so I don't know if I have a comparative advantage as an academic. I think my comparative advantage is that when I come up with an idea, even if it's based on a blog post, I have a pretty good idea of where I should try to publish that, whether it's a policy outlet or a newspaper or a scholarly journal or so on and so forth. And what the blog has been for me was, it's basically been an intellectual sketchpad for 20 years. And, you know, that's been a nice thing to have. And also what's frankly been nice is watching the discipline slowly catch up to the idea that maybe having impact is not the worst idea in the world and not the worst thing. Indeed, if anything, I now feel like an old fogey at times because I try to warn people, look, some people should try to do this. If they can, that's great. But I know all of our colleagues, and some of them I don't think should engage in public engagement at all, because that will end badly for everyone. So, you know, I always get wary of like making it like a thing that everyone should absolutely do. But it's nice to see that at least right now, you know, the way I would put it is that someone can go up for tenure, and provided their scholarship is of quality, sufficient quality, the fact that they've written a foreign affairs piece or a Washington Post op-ed or a Monkey Cage post is going to help them. It's not going to hurt them. And 20 years ago, it was going to hurt them no matter what.
So I would like to push you more on how you see the evolution of, from your perspective, as having been, you know, an early mover, having been somebody who was given a lot of shit for blogging, right? But also seeing, you know, I think there's a lot of resentment, like people both denigrated what you were doing, but they also kind of wished they were you, right? In terms of the amount of attention they were getting and the amount of offers they were getting to do public, you know, legitimate public activity. But there's clearly a kind of arc of academic engagement and academic attitudes, the way the discipline shifts on blogging and thinks about blogging. And, you know, I watched that coming in sort of at a point where it still was a little disreputable, that there were established people who would promote, like you, who would promote a new person, would, you know, offer some community, et cetera, to like where we are now. And I kind of wanted to get a sense of what you thought has happened and changed over the last 15 years, over the last 16 years.
So I would say there, if there is an inflection point, at least because we're all IR scholars within our subfield, I really do think it was when foreign policy decided to not just bring me aboard, but I think actually, if I'm being completely honest, it was Steve Walt starting the blog. Because I was someone who had, I would like to think, some intellectual, you know, gravitas even when I was blogging, but nonetheless, a lot of political scientists probably first knew me from the blog rather than my published work, my scholarly work. Whereas Walt was someone who everyone had read the scholarly work, and then he started blogging. And in some ways, I really do remember noticing, like at APSA and ISA, the difference after I moved to foreign policy was that before that, people would occasionally talk to me about the blog, but they would do so in hushed tones, whether they liked it or not. It was, again, as you say, it was somewhat disreputable. Whereas after that, suddenly it became an accepted topic of conversation, you know, in the open, as it were. It wasn't that big of a deal. And so that was interesting. And I think Steve, you know, was probably the one of the reasons for that. And now I've lost my train of thought. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
I mean, it seems to me there was a period of time when blogging started to become not just legitimate, but obligatory. And the idea was that everybody had to have a personal blog on their WordPress site.
Yeah.
There was a kind of notion that if you did it, people would come. That was just completely ridiculous. This is well after the peak of the blog.
Right.
Rush was already gone at this point.
So here I would say what people failed to understand, which, and this was actually the point that Henry and I argued in our blog piece, is that, you know, I think a lot of people, and by the way, bloggers, I think, thought this too, was that this is a democratization of discourse, right? The idea that like now everyone's got a blog, so this is great. You know, we all have our own outlets. Everyone's going to be read and so forth. And the truth is not everyone's going to be read, that there's a power law distribution to these things. And that, you know, yeah, some people might make it big, but in truth, no, most blogs that were started were going to wind up dying within 6 months because no one was going to read them, because it's not that easy necessarily to generate that kind of traffic. And that was particularly true, I think, after, 2004, 2005, when the sort of political blogosphere, as you would refer to it, kind of calcified isn't quite the right word, but like the path dependent properties had already kicked in by that point. The other thing is I would add, even though I got denied tenure in part for this, like the idea that someone would blog in grad school would actually, I would get worried and I would try to advise people not to do this, not because I thought that people would look askance at it in the sort of Chronicle of Higher Ed reason, but rather just because, you're trying to do a dissertation. The last thing you want is a means through which you can distract yourself. Towards that way lies madness. And so I was always grateful that, like, as a Gen Xer, that most of my, intellectually formative period was locked in prior to blogging.
So I want to thank both of you for Dan. I want to thank you for joining us today. We're seeing more of this project and other Dan also, thanks for joining us. I think we're going to have to do one of these where we just sort of sit down and talk out duck kind of things too, right? Because it's duck has sort of an interesting place in the history of the foreign policy blog.
But thanks so much for coming on. This was, I'm glad that this series got started, and I'm glad that we were able to get you on so soon.
No, when you told me about it, it sounded really interesting, and I really enjoyed Matt's conversation as well. So, I don't think I'm going to generate as many comments.
I also want to thank our listeners and people who keep making good suggestions about who else to interview in this series. So. Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.